Today is Tuesday, March 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, why so much information about COVID-19 remains a mystery.
In the United States, I think, have been unable to assess the size of our epidemic because the testing capacity was so extremely limited.
Plus, Afghan women say the U.S. Taliban peace deal leaves them behind. And an update from the U.S. state of Texas as Democratic voters choose their presidential nominee. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today, as the COVID-19 coronavirus spreads, World Health Organization Chief Tedros Ghebreyesus says, quote, "We are in uncharted territory," end quote. Worldwide, more than 90,000 people have been sickened and 3,100 have died in at least 70 countries. Ukraine and Morocco have just reported their first cases. South Korea saw its largest daily increase in new cases Tuesday with 851 more infections. They are focused mostly on the southeastern city of Daegu. In all, 5,186 in South Korea have tested positive. In China, new cases dropped again Tuesday with just 125 reported. It is still by far the hardest hit country with over 80,000 infections and about 95% of the world's deaths. Iran's supreme leader ordered the military to assist health officials in fighting the virus, which authorities say has killed 77, the deadliest outbreak outside China. In Italy, infections climbed to over 2,000 with 52 dead. The U.S. count has passed 100, and there have been 6 deaths there. As the virus spreads, world financial markets have been rattled by fears that it could cause a significant slowdown in trade and business. To help calm jitters, the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank today cut interest rates by 0.5 percentage point in the first emergency rate cut since the 2008 financial crisis. However, after the cut was announced, most major U.S. stock indices fell. Despite the magnitude of the outbreak, health experts still don't know answers to basic questions about COVID-19, such as how deadly the disease is, how quickly does it spread, and just how many people have been infected. The uncertainty is mainly due to lack of testing of those potentially affected, says Dr. Mark Lipsitch, who is a professor of epidemiology and director of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard University in Massachusetts. Yesterday, I spoke to Dr. Lipsitch about the importance of widespread testing. He compared the COVID-19 outbreak to an iceberg where only the tip of the outbreak is visible, while untested cases remain out of sight. Here's a clip of our conversation.
Looking at the severity of this outbreak, there's a lot of people saying, well, it spreads quite quickly, but it's not as deadly as others. How worried should we be internationally about this?
Severity is all relative. It is true that this is not as severe as SARS, for example, but SARS was one of the most deadly diseases we've seen in a while. The numbers are still very hard to interpret because we don't know the size of the clinical iceberg, the people that never get detected because they have such mild symptoms or even no symptoms. So we don't really know what the severity is in terms of your risk if you get infected. But even the best case scenario is that this is worse per infection than seasonal flu. And that best case scenario is pretty unlikely. I think it's much more likely that it's several times worse than seasonal flu. And for symptomatic people, it seems to be 10 or 20 times worse than seasonal flu in terms of the risk of dying. So this is no joke. The reason I say we don't know the overall severity is that it may be that those symptomatic people are a smaller tip of a bigger iceberg, which would be good news. And that's what we're really trying to work out, but it's uncertain at this point.
What can be done to clear up this uncertainty?
3 things: testing, testing, and testing. The way we can learn what the overall severity is to get a fuller picture of who actually has the virus. And there are 2 kinds of testing, roughly speaking, tests that look for the virus being there present at the time, which is the kind of testing that has mostly been done in this epidemic, and so-called serological testing, which tests people for whether they've made antibodies to the virus, and that tells you whether they at some point had the infection. And both of those are really important to understand the sort of size and shape of the iceberg for all these very severe cases that we know about. How many milder cases are there underneath? And I said it somewhat facetiously, testing, testing, and testing, because the United States has trailed the world in getting that capacity up and running. We're beginning to make that better. But we in the United States, I think, have been unable to assess the size of our epidemic because the testing capacity was so extremely limited. And so I think many other countries that know they have bigger epidemics may not have larger ones than we do. They may just know more about them.
And what can be done to ramp up that capacity? Are there enough test kits out there? Or do countries have access to them? Or is it more like in the U.S., a policy issue where there seems to have been some slowness on the part of the U.S. government to want to test more people?
It's both. The policy issue seems to be getting dealt with to some extent in the United States. There's a very, very restrictive FDA, Food and Drug Administration policy about which kinds of laboratories could do tests, and that's being improved. The supply of test kits I'm less clear about, but given what I've heard about the anticipated numbers in the United States after this regulatory logjam is dealt with, I'm still concerned that we're going to be way under testing. For some perspective, the province of Guangdong in southern China tested over 300,000 people, mild cases of illness, where they didn't know whether they had coronavirus or not, and they were just trying to get a sense of the representation of coronavirus among mild cases. That was 300,000 tests in about 3 or 4 weeks. We don't have that kind of capacity as a country at this point, and I don't think we will unless we redouble these efforts to expand our capacity.
And is that the case worldwide? You mentioned China, but you know, in Europe, in Italy, for example, there have been a lot of cases in South Korea where they've been doing lots of testing. There are, of course, lots of cases. But in other parts of the world, like Africa, for instance, we've seen very, very few cases. And do you think that could be simply the result of a lack of tests?
Yes, I think that's also the result of a lack of tests. Capacity to test is necessary in all places for clinical care and for protection of healthcare workers and for other reasons like that. To some extent, I think we can rely on the testing in the countries that have done it first to get some understanding of the nature of this disease, assuming that it's fairly similar across populations. Not every country needs to do detailed epidemiologic studies, but certainly the more information we have, the better we can control it. It's not academic. It's about how to control the virus and what sort of response and what size of response is needed.
That was Dr. Mark Lipsitch, director of Harvard University's Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics in Massachusetts. Now, in an aggressive means of combating the COVID-19 outbreak, Australia is preparing to use strict biosecurity laws to force people suspected of carrying the virus into hospitals or quarantine. Parliamentarians in South Australia state are considering laws to allow police to detain people deemed at risk of spreading the disease. For VOA, journalist Phil Mercer filed this report from Sydney.
Coronavirus patients could be forcibly detained in Australia. Under biosecurity laws passed in 2015, the authorities have the power to hold and decontaminate people with the COVID-19 virus and stop them going to sporting events, schools and shopping centres. Federal Attorney General Christian Porter told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that detaining patients would be a last resort.
I mean, there will be certain circumstances where there are penalties for failing to abide by an order. Detention can occur under the Act, but it is rare and very much a last resort, and it exists for the types of requirements like compelling someone to go to a medical facility.
Australia has more than 30 verified cases of the disease, but experts believe a mass outbreak is still avoidable. For the first time, person-to-person transmission has also been confirmed in 2 patients in Sydney. Australia's first coronavirus death was recorded at the weekend. The 78-year-old man died more than a week after being put into isolation in hospital in the city of Perth. He had been in quarantine since being evacuated from the Diamond Princess cruise ship held in the Japanese port of Yokohama. His wife has tested positive for the COVID-19 virus and is reported to be in a stable condition. Australia has imposed a travel ban on foreigners arriving from Iran because of the outbreak. Similar restrictions have applied to mainland China for more than a month. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, quote, sounded the alarm, end quote, Tuesday on Iran's nuclear program, demanding clarifications from Tehran. The UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency reported that Iran has nearly tripled its stockpile of enriched uranium over the past 3 months in violation of its deal with world powers while refusing to answer questions about three possible undeclared nuclear sites. The agency's statement was in a confidential report distributed to member countries and seen by news agencies. The report said Iran's total enriched uranium stockpile amounted to 1,020.9 kilograms. The nuclear deal that Iran signed in 2015 with world powers allows the country to have only 202.8 kilograms. Since U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of that deal in 2018, Iran has slowly been violating its restrictions. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny said Tuesday that authorities had frozen all of his bank accounts and those of his family. Navalny is an outspoken opponent of President Vladimir Putin and said his accounts had been frozen, as had the bank cards of his wife, son, daughter, and elderly parents. The opposition figure said the freezes appeared linked to a criminal case investigators opened into suspected money laundering by his anti-corruption foundation. Navalny says the allegations are fabricated. The Kremlin declined to discuss the blocking of Navalny's accounts, saying bank freezes were not a matter for the president's office. And Turkey shot down a Syrian government warplane on Tuesday over northwest Syria, where fighting has intensified in recent days, bringing Turkish and Russian forces close to direct conflict in the battle over the last area Syrian rebels hold. It was the third Syrian warplane Turkey has shot down since Sunday. NATO member Turkey supports the rebels, while President Bashar al-Assad relies on his ally Russia. Fighting was raging north of the strategic crossroads town of Sarakeb, which the Syrian troops recaptured on Monday, one of several times the town has changed hands. In the U.S., it's Super Tuesday, when Democratic Party voters in 14 states choose their nominee to run against President Donald Trump in November. It's the closest thing to a national primary poll in the U.S., and today's results could go a long way to determining what the rest of the nomination process will look like. For more, we now go live to VOA correspondent Carolyn Presutti in Texas, where voting is underway. Hello, Carolyn. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jason. Thanks so much, and welcome to Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, tell us, what's the mood right now in Dallas? How is the voting going? Things going smoothly for people there?
Everyone is headed to the polls today. They opened about 4 hours ago here. They'll continue to stay open for another 8 hours. But, of course, Texas is the winning jewel behind California in the Super Tuesday vote. When 14 states vote, California has the most delegates up for grabs, followed by Texas.
And so there's been some late changes in the race. There was the sudden dropout of Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar in the past day or two. In particular, Klobuchar, she has now endorsed Joe Biden, and you were there when she introduced him. Can you tell us what that rally was like?
Absolutely. That happened last night in Dallas, Texas. Just hundreds crowded into this ballroom dance hall in Dallas, Texas, to support former Vice President Joe Biden. And it was Amy Klobuchar who introduced the vice president by saying, "This is a candidate who can put our country back together to heal." And of course, then the crowd just erupted with chants, "Let's go, Joe. Let's go, Joe." So that got them fired up. Amy Klobuchar was there to suspend her campaign, as you mentioned. I've spoken to a lot of Democratic experts, and they kind of explained it this way. They said the Democratic establishment got together, kind of looked at the moderates who were still in the race, and they decided who to put their money on, who to put their support behind. And that was definitely Vice President Joe Biden after he won South Carolina on Saturday. Amazingly, ever since that win on Saturday, he's received 19 major endorsements from Democrats, including Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar and his other rival, who was former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
Now, there are differing opinions from voters in various states about latecomer Michael Bloomberg. Is he a spoiler or is he a wild card in this race? What are you hearing from Texans about the New York billionaire?
Exactly. You know, this is the first time he's on the ballot in this country for these 14 Super Tuesday states. And I've spoken to different people in Texas who say, yes, we want to support him because we think he's the only one who can beat President Donald Trump. So he gets a lot of support from that. Now, last night at that rally, I did speak to a Republican woman who said, if Bloomberg ends up being the nominee, I'm not sure who I'm going to vote for. So that was kind of interesting to hear her, but yet she was at a Biden rally. She said, I want to keep my options open. That's what I'm hearing from Texans. We'll see how they vote today. But Bloomberg, interestingly enough, is in Florida today. Now, that primary isn't until March 17th. So that gives the idea that he's going to stay in the race. And his big quote, of course, is, I'm in it to win it. And he has enough money. I mean, he's already spent nearly $500 million on this race.
Now, Bloomberg used to be a Republican, so he's obviously quite moderate, as is Joe Biden. But, of course, the front runner in this race is Bernie, who is the flag bearer of the left wing of the Democratic Party. And Warren is also still in the race. She's even ahead of Bloomberg. So looking at, in your conversations with Texans, how do people feel about this divide that is within the Democratic Party, where you have Bernie and Warren representing the left wing of the party, whereas you have Biden and now Bloomberg, who are kind of more moderate, leaning towards the center?
It depends on what kind of voter you talk to. The people who want change, who really want a revolution within the Democratic Party, will support Sanders or Warren, as you mentioned. People in Texas say they want a fresh face. They want somebody new in the office. Now, the thing that may go against Sanders, though, is that by Inauguration Day, he would be 79 years old, and he would be the oldest president in history. I see a lot of young people going for Sanders, again, for the freshness, for something new, for a different outlook on this country. Sanders supporting Medicare for All and free college tuition, of course, that is very desirable for this age group.
That was VOA correspondent Carolyn Pursuti in Texas. Thanks for joining us, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you, Jason.
Now, in Afghanistan, U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper recently said that the United States will begin a partial withdrawal down to 8,600 U.S. troops in the coming days after signing a landmark agreement with the Taliban over the weekend. But he added that that doesn't mean violence will end in the war-torn country.
This was an important first step toward a political solution to end the war in Afghanistan. As I reiterated to our Afghan partners, this is a conditions-based agreement. We're watching the Taliban's actions closely to assess whether they are upholding their commitments.
Esper said the U.S. expects violence in Afghanistan would diminish to ultimately reach a ceasefire. The imminent U.S. withdrawal comes amid reports of violence in several areas of the country. Esper stressed that the U.S. would still be conducting military operations against Islamic State and other non-Taliban groups in Afghanistan. And meanwhile, Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid said the reduction in violence agreement, which had held before the deal's signing, has now ended, so Taliban operations would continue against the Afghan government. To better understand what all this means and whether the reduction in violence will hold, I spoke earlier today to the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for Afghanistan, Andrew Watkins, who is in Kabul.
The thing that your listeners might notice and that really comes across in media coverage is the difference in the agreement being signed and this being hailed as a historic moment, and unfortunately a little bit too much confusion believing that this might be some sort of peace deal, when in fact this was an arrangement between the U.S. and Taliban that was only going to start the process of peace negotiations between the different Afghan parties to the conflict. And so, of course, in the following days, we've seen a hardening in the posture, in the rhetoric, and in the battlefield behavior from both sides in different ways. A lot of this seems to have been expected. I think what it shows is how fragile and how delicate the Afghan conflict really was. It took a lot of hard work just to get up to this early stage. and there's still so many more hurdles to overcome before a peace process can even get started.
And looking at some of the statements that have been made, the U.S. Defense Secretary said that, okay, the process of drawing down troops will begin. But at the same time, he also said, look, we're going to continue our operations against groups like the Islamic State in Afghanistan. And at the same time, the Taliban has said, look, we're going to continue our operations as well against the Afghanistan government forces rather than U.S. forces.
On the U.S. side, this makes sense because the U.S. now has to juggle these very new commitments that it has made with a former adversary, the Taliban. The issue of trust is still really vital, but the United States still has a lot to do to reassure its long-term partner, the Afghan government, that this is not, like some critics and some media coverage have portrayed, a surrender of Afghanistan or a retreat from Afghanistan. On the Taliban side, the declaration to continue fighting, and they were very clear, they specified that they would not target foreign forces, only Afghan security forces. This makes sense from the group's perspective as well. Their dedication and commitment to the adversary used to be the foreign occupation, and now it's the government that they've often referred to as a puppet government for the Westerners. This is what binds this group together. The Taliban have shown that they have some command and control, but once those fighters stop fighting, will they answer the Taliban's call anymore? And so in a sense, it's very important for the Taliban to keep that network and to keep its movement active. It's also important for them. They want to keep pressure on the Afghan government going into talks, because of an insurgency, violence is really their primary form of leverage.
Looking for the next few days or few weeks, what would be necessary to see from the different sides to start seeing an actual reduction in some of this violence?
The reduction of violence that took place in the week before the agreement was signed did not completely eliminate conflict in the country, but it did bring it down dramatically. People say that it made up anywhere from a 60 to 80% drop from normal levels of violence. Today, even with the Taliban's announcement, violence is nowhere near these 80 incidents a day that constituted a normal day in Afghanistan for most of last year. The Taliban are definitely making a show of demonstrating that they believe their obligation for that reduction of violence period is over, but they are also keeping it constrained.
So really, even though there has been some violence, we're really not seeing the level of war that we previously had seen. So essentially, if things hold steady as they are, even though it's not true peace, it's certainly better than it used to be.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And you asked, what steps would we need to see? I think one of them is even this limited progress, as difficult as it is for Afghans most of all to accept, in broader terms, it is a step down. It is a de-intensification of the conflict. That's important, and that will need to hold if these talks are going to move forward.
That was International Crisis Group's senior analyst for Afghanistan, Andrew Watkins, in Kabul. Now, the U.S. Taliban agreement has raised hopes for peace, but it also has raised concerns that Afghan women may lose rights and freedoms once the U.S. troops withdraw. VOA journalists spoke to women in Afghanistan to get their view. Here's Halima Salimi, head of Herat Women's Network.
I think that the U.S. Taliban deal mostly reflects the U.S. and the Taliban's interests rather than the rights of the Afghan government and the people, in particular, women.
The U.S. Taliban agreement has paved the way for an intra-Afghan dialogue, and in those negotiations, the Afghan government wants to get concrete commitments from the Taliban to protect women's rights. There are some signs the Taliban wants to do so, but at the same time, the Taliban has warned against mingling between men and women. That has raised fears about freedom of movement and women's social and political engagement. Afghan student Hasiba Moshtaq shared these concerns. Despite these fears, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Morgan Ortegas rejected criticism that the U.S. has not prioritized women's rights in talks with the Taliban. That's going to do it for us today. You have been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Thanks to our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Nashwan Kala. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great evening.